Welcome to the Arbitration Conversation with Amy Schmitz.
Hello, and welcome to the Arbitration Conversation. So in this arbitration conversation, we once again have a real rock star in the area of arbitration, mediation, and negotiation. And we have a very kind person to boot. So this is going to be an extra fun and wonderful conversation. I'm looking forward to it. So today we have Joan Stearns Johnson. She specializes in alternative dispute resolution and skills training, including negotiation, mediation, and arbitration. Professor Johnson also coaches the International Commercial Arbitration Moot Court Competition Team and is co-faculty advisor to the ADR team. She's also director of the Institute for Dispute Resolution at University of Florida. Professor Johnson has over 30 years of experience in mediation, arbitration, including a background in banking and financial, employment, health law, and other large and complex commercial matters. And her teaching reflects her experience. I saw her in action at UF, and she's amazing, and her students love her, especially because she has a broad range of practical experience, which we'll get into in terms of thinking about arbitration as a problem-solving tool. She's part of panels of the AAA, the International Center for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, and FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. She's also a fellow of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators and is certified by the IMI and accredited by the Center for Effective Dispute Resolution, otherwise known as CEDAR. I can say a lot more, but I want to hear more about her journey from her. So thank you so much, Joan. I'm so happy that you're able to join us.
Amy, thank you. I'm so happy to join you. And I have to say that you are the rock star. I saw you teaching my class at UF and was blown away. You are amazing.
Well, let's get right into hearing. One thing I'd like to ask is I think everyone sort of comes into ADR through different journeys, different roads. And when you first go to law school, I think many of us don't really think about ADR right away. You know, everything is so doctrinal. All the classes are very focused on litigation. And so, you know, it's always interesting to hear, well, what brought you to ADR? So, and especially, you know, you had been the chair of the ABA section of dispute resolution. So not just a little ADR, but a lot of ADR. So could you tell us a little bit about your journey and what brought you to dispute resolution?
Well, first, that is so true. And it's all ADR all the time. But it is so true about journeys, because sometimes the best journeys are the ones you don't plan and the ones you didn't expect. And most people, when you ask about their journey, they didn't plan it. It's the rare person who planned it. So my journey was I wanted to litigate. I just wanted to litigate. I thought that would be so much fun, ho, 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 not what it appears to be on TV. And my first job was with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in Washington, D.C., as an enforcement attorney, as a regulator, as a litigator. But when I got into that industry, into that field, commodities is based on the SEC, and the rules of practice come from the SEC rules of practice, and the culture comes directly from the SEC culture, which is where the arbitration comes from. So arbitration historically has existed in this area of practice since the turn of the century, like the late 19th century. And we looked up the name of the tree. It was under the buttonwood tree, where the members used to go outside and resolve their disputes with what, I don't know if they called it arbitration or Judge Judy or small claims, but it was essentially an arbitration process. And I don't know if most people know, but each exchange, I was in-house at an exchange for a while, has their own arbitration process. So
why do you think that is? Yeah, I mean, and I guess it's sort of our theme for today, thinking about problem solving. You know, do you think, I mean, especially that's amazing, like that history and how long that's been happening. And they don't care what you call it. Doesn't matter if you call it, you know, goofballs decide. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's just the fact that they were solving problems. What do you think? What do you think was the reason why, especially in the area of securities, that it's been the main mode for resolving disputes?
Well, arbitration in those days, the way it was done, was quick, cheap, and efficient and good. So if you had a beef with somebody you were trading with, you get one of the wise elders and boom, boom, done. One side, another side, and moving on. I think that's probably why.
Well, and also I wonder, you know, and I think, and that's so important because sometimes, you know, going back in history and thinking about why arbitration made so much sense for that area and why it continues to be the mode for resolving disputes, of course, with FINRA. But I wonder, well, also you can have an expert, right? Somebody who actually understands the industry, not a generalist judge.
Exactly. The industry expertise and respect in the process leads to respect in the result. So when it's a wise elder chosen by both sides and agreed to by both sides, then you're going to have confidence in the result and you're going to be able to move on. And that's the beauty of arbitration. And I mean, I think that historical process accentuates some of the differences between arbitration and litigation in court. Its strengths.
Yeah. Well, and for you too. So, you know, I know, you're an enforcement attorney for the Commodities Future Commission in Washington, D.C. You work in-house with a commodity exchange. How did you then decide, okay, I'm going to be an arbitrator, mediator, you're going to be a leader in the field? I mean, goodness gracious, you even won the James P. Groton Award for Outstanding Leadership in Dispute Prevention by the Conflict Prevention Resolution Institute in 2023. So what, you know, because that's a nice job. You have an enforcement, you're in-house, like you've got all these, you know, what kind of made you say, you know what, I'm going to teach, I'm going to be focused on dispute resolution and kind of move into this really all in on ADR?
Just lucky, I guess.
There's more to it, I'm sure. What do they say about luck? White, right? Isn't it tons of preparation plus something else is what
opportunity.
Yeah, there you go.
I think it's because litigation isn't what we all think it is. I did not like litigation. I thought it was awful. I mean, there's surely the fact that it makes more sense. It draws on all of your neurons. Dispute resolution, I mean, first of all, it's so different, arbitration from mediation. And you mentioned prevention. Thank you. I'm passionate about prevention. But I think it's really, well, we know there's going to be conflict. And we assume that litigation is the best way to resolve conflict. I don't think that's true. Not in all cases. So I don't know. It draws on all of your neurons, creativity, your intellectual skills, your knowledge of your specialty area. It's challenging. It's fun.
Yeah.
I feel rewarding.
Right. Well, and you can't. There's more. You know, even just I also did. I was in litigation first. And realized very quickly, wait a minute, this is really not what I want to do long term. And then ended up moving into construction law so that I could do arbitration, mediation, dispute resolution before I sort of left private practice. And I completely understand that feeling where you just realize, wait a minute, I don't think this is the best way to help my client. And I think the problem solving aspect is so much more important when it comes to arbitration. I wondered your thoughts on that.
I think lawyers should be looking at themselves not as litigators or transaction lawyers, but as problem solvers. I think that would make our clients that much happier. I think that would raise the reputation of lawyers if they were more, it would make them more client service oriented, we should be problem solvers. The rules of professional responsibility require us to be problem solvers. And
yeah,
that leads to all the mechanisms.
I know. I really do actually want to open a problem solving school to compete with the law schools.
Can I come work with you? I want to
you
come
wanna
work
join
with
me?
You.
Okay, we'll join. We'll start together. We're making news here. I would, man, if I had the startup money. But yeah,
right?
I think I agree with you so much. You know, and thinking about kind of how this is a tool in the toolbox, and in thinking about arbitration as a tool in the problem solving toolbox. Obviously, you've got mediation, you've got negotiation, you have everything in between. Is there anything in particular you've ever run across that was so creative and different, perhaps in this area of problem solving or prevention?
Ah, you have opened the door to one of my favorite topics. It's a little bit less than arbitration, although the processes could be adjudicative. So if you think about lawyers as problem solvers, why do we have to wait until there's a problem? If we understand, and I don't know who I'm quoting, but I'm quoting everybody and including myself. Oh, I think getting to yes, you don't have buildings show up at court, at a mediation, at an arbitration. You have people show up. So if we understand fundamentally all of these people problems, and if we understand where these problems come from, and that it basically stems from a breakdown in a relationship, in trust, in communication, then we don't have to wait until things blow up irretrievably. If we maintain the relationship, and I'm not speaking of husband and wife or that type of relationship, I'm really speaking about commercial relationships where companies are not in the business of litigating, where they want to focus on business purpose. They don't want to be spending time and resources litigating, and they really would rather maintain the relationship with the deal partner that made sense from the beginning. And you know this from construction. Construction is so far ahead in all of these techniques. So dispute prevention is recognizing that conflict is inevitable, disputes are not, and managing a relationship from the inception throughout the life of the relationship, anticipating that circumstances will change, that there will be problems, the widgets will be the wrong size, but with communication, with rapport, with trust, with negotiation, you can navigate those bumps in the road without heading for the courthouse or the arbitration house.
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, arbitration can be a wonderful sort of backstop, you know, for when there's no other better way. But I think sometimes, you know, the problem is that individuals don't want to invest in something like a conflict coach or really invest in prevention because they assume there won't be any problems. I always call this the kumbaya phase of contracting. You know, you first enter into the contract and you think, oh, everything's going to be fine. We're not going to have any problems. And then you inevitably do, especially in large business contexts. And then the problem that becomes much more expensive, right? Like we know, you know, what is the saying? A penny wise, a pound foolish, right? Because you think you're saving money by not setting anything up at the beginning, right? And during the relationship. But especially when there's a lot of money at stake, when it's a large project, and yeah, you're right, construction, they're sort of ahead of the game on a lot of this because they've been doing things like dispute resolution boards and other processes because they know it's going to happen. And if you have something in place, you will end up saving money and time is money.
Oh, I agree with you. I so agree with you. So the champagne clause, we all know the champagne clause. that they cut and paste because they assume that there are never going to be any problems. That just, why do they still do that?
I know. And now that we've got data, I think it's human psychology. I really do. I think it's because I was reading actually about psychology and how it converges with dispute prevention and resolution and kind of litigation and sort of how our brains, why do we do this, right? Why do we not, we assume everything will be, because we are over optimistic. As much as we think we're sort of, you know, surly and pessimistic, I think we actually are over optimistic. I know I can be guilty of this as well, right? You purchase something, it won't break, it'll be fine, even though it's really, really cheap and we know it's going to break. You know what I mean? But
not for me, anyway. It's not going to break with me.
No. Maybe everyone else, but like for me,
not for me. So they say that they like 50% of marriages end in divorce or some statistic like that. But if you stood in line and asked everybody in line to get their marriage license, they're going to say, not me, not me, not me. So I think that's true. I also think some of the reasons are that lawyers especially, but business people are risk averse. They don't want to change the paradigm. So if you move to this sort of an approach, you're changing the paradigm. I think people assume that they have the skill set that we all know they don't, because there's so much miscommunication. You know, that's where all our cases come from. I also think that our system is incentivizing litigation.
Right, for sure. Even just the way that we set up law school incentivizes it, because we're wiring students' brains by focusing on doctrinal litigation their whole first year. You know, I think it's really smart when law schools do have, you know, a class in the first year introducing students to problem solving and lawyering and dispute resolution, because of the fact that then they're not so focused only on litigation. You know, I think it's
on rules-based sort of results.
Yeah, right.
The results have to be rules-based. They can't be interest-based.
Right. And interest-based might be something totally different than rules-based. Yeah. What are some specific ideas? You know, we've seen, of course, what construction does, but in other industries, what are some sort of specific ideas, let's say a large corporation is thinking very seriously about dispute prevention or managing conflict, managing relationships. Maybe you want to share an idea or two about things, you know, for a listener who's thinking, you know, I have this large company, I have a lot of people to manage. What are some ways to kind of build dispute prevention into a corporate kind of ecosystem?
So I will cite some successes. In the pharmaceutical industry, they have what's called alliance managers, because in the pharmaceutical industry, there may be multiple joint ventures. And if a joint venture fails and they wind up in litigation and destroy that relationship, they are not just destroying a joint venture, that could have implications for other joint ventures. So it's really important to maintain their relationships. So these alliance managers, one from each company, manage that relationship. They are focused less on the deal, but on the relationship. And that helps. That's one success. Another success is Intel, which engages in a lot of construction, has a program that Howard Karsman, shout out to Howard Karsman, managed for many years, set up and managed, where they have standing neutrals. So granted, Intel has more leverage. They can require their contractors and subs to sign on for this program, but the neutrals are neutral. So everything is handled with appropriate neutrality, and the neutrals come in when there are those bumps in the road, that friction that can escalate to a dispute, and they help facilitate ways through them. And Intel, in the number of years that Howard was managing this program, had, I believe the statistic last I heard was $12 billion with a B in construction with one, I think it was, was it a million or 100 million, one little dispute with a sub that he was not happy that they actually had one finally. But that's a rather astonishing record. You can also look to the construction industry, which uses dispute review boards, which have various models, various approaches. Sometimes it's facilitative, often it's adjudicative, which is fine, it's quicker, but they're being creative to keep projects moving and stay out of court. So those are some examples, and it can work. It's so intuitive, don't you think?
Oh, I absolutely. So at Missouri, University of Missouri, we had campus mediation services. And even in looking at the data, it was so clear that we could save the university so much money by not having things blow up into very ugly litigation that costs a lot and harms reputation and hurts relationships and hurts people. You know, I also love it when I see at universities that they've set up at University of Colorado, we had where we trained students as mediators and then they became mediators for dorm disputes. So that was really wonderful because it was a way to really preserve relationships and really helps the university on larger levels. And also was a wonderful learning experience for the students. So you had sort of this ecosystem of pedagogy plus prevention plus learning, you know, relationships. I love when you can kind of connect all these different sort of systems and ecosystems. And I'm glad you mentioned, I love the example with Alliance and also with the Intel example, because I love, yeah, these are just so many different creative ways that we can prevent disputes from really erupting into large scale litigation. I mean, I always say to students as well that, you know, to look for, especially students that are very, very interested in dispute resolution, they don't really want to litigate. They don't want to sort of go into traditional legal practice, but, you know, working with an HR department and helping to manage relationships there, you're using dispute resolution skills, you know, or ombuds programs.
These skills are magic. They are transferable to whether you are working as an ombuds, whether you're working as a mediator, whether you're working as a mediation advocate, or whether you're just dealing with office politics or a spouse. Or, I mean, the skill set is founded in science. We call them soft skills, but there's so much science. And they're incredibly powerful. And I want to point out, because, you know, trying to get companies to use this approach rather than what they've always used, look at how much money you mentioned, how much money companies are saving, and how hard have we been working and continuing to work to let companies know that mediation is a good thing, let alone prevention.
Yeah.
It's not easy to change the status quo.
Yeah, no, it's not. And why is that so? Oh, it's frustrating because you're right. And it's not just saving money from the litigation or, but it's also, you know, things like, for example, you know, bringing on, finding and retaining good employees is actually very expensive on so many levels. And so having, you know, an ombuds program or having a means for managing relationships and preventing disputes when it comes to your employees and HR is really, really important for saving money, not just on the litigation side, but also in terms of losing talent. And that's huge. And we were talking about earlier, I think the time aspect with construction is a perfect example because time is money. I mean, the biggest damages there are delay damages. We all know that. So figuring out ways to kind of save all the time, but also the health effects and stress effects. I don't know if you want to talk to that at all, because I think litigation, there's so much data to support that litigation actually harms people's physical health.
So we teach magic, right, Amy?
Yeah, there we go. Okay, more for our new school that we're going to start.
There we go. We're going to call it, we're going to have a class in magic.
Yes, I love it. Well, and that kind of bring, I mean, because we were going to talk a little bit about technology as well, as we mentioned before we started taping, and it kind of is a good segue because I think about, I always say, you know, give to humans what humans do best and give to technology what technology does best. And I think we need to become more adept at figuring out the difference. And one area where humans are better are these kind of skills that really think about problem solving in a deep way that is creative and considers all these different psychological impacts, because they don't always make sense from just a simple like cost-benefit analysis.
Do you think that the traders at the New York Stock Exchange would have been happy handing their dispute to AI?
Heck no.
Why?
Yeah, because first of all, relationships, reputations, face saving, I mean, all of that is so important, and especially in areas where, you know, they're trading on a regular basis. I mean, that's why arbitration continued during the American Revolutionary War. There were people, merchants in the US who were still trading with people in Britain, and then if they did have a dispute or a problem, they would still arbitrate it, even though the courts were closed because we were at war.
How did they choose? Wow. And how did they choose the arbitrator?
An expert that they all who knew the area, whatever it was, whatever kind of trade you were involved in. Yeah, that was, I was doing this research for an article where I kind of went down a rabbit hole of looking at all history of whatever. And yeah, and I thought that was so interesting. But you don't, if you're still selling and buying things in your particular area, I mean, there's that very famous study with the diamond dealers, for example, and how they really don't even care about the law. It's really about the trade norms. That's all that matters. And reputation and an elder and someone who you trust who's in the field, right? You know, that's so
Right.
huge. That's why there's that classic battle that, you know, even in Commonwealth Codings, Justice White in his concurrence talks about sort of this. Because on the one hand, you might have an arbitrator who has a connection with someone by some whatever because they're an expert, because they're in
Right.
the field.
Right.
So it's like, okay, are they an expert or is there an appearance of bias? Or, you know, so it's kind of this, I don't know, it's interesting from a problem solving perspective. I mean, I think we have to be very careful with disclosures and accepting, but I always think that that's just, yeah, that's a great question. How do they select them? But I mean, if you're just, you're still selling and buying stuff.
Well, that's such a good point because it was someone known to both. So, in terms of disclosure, it wasn't, I mean, so there's a difference between bias and expertise. And there's a difference, the disclosure doesn't mean that you can't have any relationship. I mean, so it could be somebody who, from a very small world, you know, diamond dealers, where everybody knows everybody. And both sides know the person and they don't care.
Well, and quite honestly, that used to happen when I was practicing in Seattle. There was one particular person who we always selected because he was the expert, and we knew he was the expert, and the other side knew he was the expert. So
Right.
we both would just do an ad hoc arbitration, select this person because
Right.
they were in the construction industry and knew everything and knew everyone,
And
right?
was
So,
fair. And were unbiased, and
yeah.
however many cases they had done for you, they still were unbiased and fair and regarded, yeah, but that's back to the old buttonwood tree,
Yeah,
which is the
right.
beauty, which we've strayed from
Right,
arbitration
right, right.
from that.
Yeah, and I think it all still fits within the theme of sort of problem solving, because I think when you're really trying to solve a problem, you have to think about prevention. You have to think about what are the reasons for using that tool in the toolbox. Sometimes the reasons include expertise, and sometimes that's actually the most important reason, right? So I
Right.
think we have to sort of categorize and think, all right, so what is the reason that we want to use this process? What are our goals? Who are the stakeholders? And we have to think about it from a very methodic sort of system design perspective. And sometimes expertise is more important than it being completely and totally independent, such that nobody knows that person, right? And I think that's all really important. Yeah, I guess the last piece that really doesn't fit into this theme anymore. But we, at one point, we were talking a bit about before we started taping in terms of Section 7 of the Federal Arbitration Act, which I'm, of course, fascinated by it. And we had some nice discussions about it. But I think it fits in with the theme of kind of problem solving and the Federal Arbitration Act. Are there certain areas of the Federal Arbitration Act that might need to be updated for the listener who hasn't kept up on their dates of when the law passed? But the Federal Arbitration Act passed in 1925. It's almost coming on its 100th birthday. So from that perspective, you know, what do you think? So Section 7 has created this a bit of disagreement about whether or not online hearings, in an online hearing, are you able to use Section 7 or subpoena documents at and witnesses from third parties, right? So it's easy if it's, if they're a party to the arbitration agreement, yeah, we'll put it in the arbitration agreement. It's in within the arbitrator's power. It's fine. But what happens when you have a third party and that has become an issue and courts don't necessarily agree? I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, Joan.
Well, I mean, I think it ties into how far we've come from the
Buttonwood
real of what arbitration is supposed to be, how arbitration started, and looking back at 1925, what they envisioned for arbitration, as opposed to all of the employment cases and the consumer cases and just the breadth of how it's being used now, and also how the people who practice arbitration have, what do they call it? Arbogation or litigation?
Oh yeah. Tom Stepanowicz calls it arba litigation or
arba litigation, something like that. Right. So they're moving it more and more in that direction. And Section 7, as it was promulgated, didn't anticipate all of this pre-hearing discovery, right? It was quick. Everybody had what they had and you got it, you resolved it and you moved on. And now there's, you know, so Section 7 provides that an arbitrator has subpoena powers for parties to appear before the arbitrator at the hearing. So the definition of, you know, the hearing and the hearing on the merits and before the arbitrator becomes rather sticky when you're looking at third party discovery, because parties, you can make parties turn stuff over. But being able to make a third party turn something over, and if they don't want to, how do you then enforce it? And so there's a circuit split about what constitutes the hearing on the merits. And if it's, you know, who wants to show up at a hearing on the merits and get 1,000 documents from, you know, 10,000 documents from the other side? So that's not in as it's been interpreted, certainly by the 11th Circuit.
Oh, and now it's gotten more complicated. Yeah, because there is, of course, we have this split of authority on whether pre-hearing discovery is permitted from third parties under Section 7. But now it's gotten even messier because we have managed care associates. And now we've got this question about whether you can even make someone show up for an online hearing because of those
right.
words before them. Before
right.
the arbitrator's meaning, what does the word before mean? Does that mean you have to be physically before them? Is it
right.
okay to be Zoom before them?
Because as we know, the drafters in 1925 did not contemplate telephonic hearings.
Heck no. I mean,
video.
No, I mean, I'm sorry. I even, and I'll admit, when I saw the Jetsons, I did not think that that would ever be true.
But right. The Jetsons. I know we need, where are those packs, those backpacks that help us fly over I want a car that flies over the traffic too. But so I don't know. So it's, if we're going to keep moving in arbitration, that needs to be straightened out. That's kind of ridiculous. So you can, I mean, one option is you can do a state arbitration act, but then you have a problem if the stuff is out of state. And it's not clear. It's a problem. And that I think is an easy fix that would, I don't know that either side of the aisle would object to that.
I know. Yeah. And it's funny how we get so many arbitration cases, but instead of answering some of these really problematic from a practical perspective, really problematic disagreements like this, we end up with cases that just leave more questions.
Right. And the other, like some people have said, well, you don't want to expand discovery in arbitration, right? So give them more power, you're expanding. To me, that's a red herring, because you still have arbitrators who can control and they don't have to give everything. But the inability to order, like even in a securities case, if you have to send a subpoena to a company that has financial records and they're out of their, you know, it's a third party, they don't want to turn it over. The bank doesn't want to turn it over.
No.
Without a subpoena. Is an arbitrator going to issue a subpoena that they know is really not enforceable? So yeah, we need to fix that. And then we need to do other things so we have fewer arbitration cases. How's that?
Yeah, I know. We need less litigation about arbitration, I think, personally, so that we can streamline things. Well, this has been wonderful because we sort of covered a lot of territory, which is great because I needed to get my steps today. And I feel like we still had the same theme in thinking about problem solving, solving problems in the FAA, solving problems in relationships and how we use arbitration, and of course, solving problems with law schools.
We solved the problem. We're starting our own law school.
I know. Yep. I love it. Oh my gosh. All right. I'll start looking for grants. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for taking time out of your holiday week. And I really hope that you have a wonderful rest of 2023 and a wonderful Happy New Year to you.
Amy, thank you so much. What a treat. Just a pleasure. Thank you. And yes, same to you. Happy, happy, Merry Christmas. Happy, healthy New Year. Happy, healthy 2024.
This podcast was brought to you by Arbitrate.com. For more information about Arbitrate.com's programs and content, please visit our website at www.arbitrate.com.